This is the Linksys from Me Too podcast series with Gregor Ross and Andy Wallace. Welcome to the Linksys from Me Too podcast. I'm here with my co-founder, Gregor Ross.
Hi, Andy. How you doing?
Not bad. And also here with Anthony Rafferty from Origo.
Well enunciated.
Yes, thank you very much. I just thought I'd get out of there. So really, Anthony, just to tell you a bit of background on the From Me Too podcast, we look into the background of our guests and explore their experiences and which have led them to their successes. The good, the bad, and the ugly is what we're looking to sort of learn about. So we're delighted to have you here to learn more about yourself and your company. So why don't we kick off with you just telling us a bit about Origo and what the company does?
Yeah, sure. So Origo is a fintech, financial technology business. We're actually old for a fintech. We reckon we're the original fintech. So we're 35 years old. Mm-hmm. So we were born in the same year as the World Wide Web. Our job really is to connect the financial services marketplace through a series of digital services. We're best known for pension transfers. We have another brand called Unipass. And that's a security login brand, essentially for financial advisors. We're based in Edinburgh, but we serve the whole of the UK. We're what we're up to now, 125 staff. But I'm sure we'll get into a lot more about that as well. So that's Origo.
Great summary. Thanks, Anthony. So,
and you've been with them since?
I joined 2018, the very beginning of 2018, pre-COVID, pre-sort of grey hair. So that's the longest job I've had, actually, 7.5 years. I think my record before that was 5 years, but loving it.
Yeah.
So that's you at the moment. So if we rewind, go right back up to start, you okay speaking for a few minutes about your upbringing, the early part of your career?
Yeah, sure. So I'm from Edinburgh. I was brought up, born in 1970.
Good year.
In a place called Wester Hills, So council estate in Edinburgh. At the time, Edinburgh was not a very good reputation. It was known as the drugs capital of Europe. Mm-hmm. Wester Hills was the drugs capital of Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And I had a wonderful upbringing. Seemed to be cocooned from all that. I was not aware of the fact that it was a council estate.
Yeah.
And I sort of... a rougher part of Edinburgh, very good parents. My father was a senior civil servant. My mother could have been the prime minister, but she was a dinner lady and a mm-hmm. civil servant herself as well. Mm-hmm. Youngest of three, so big sister, big brother, and then myself. Incredibly, I still can't believe this, that if I think to my life, my mother was 22 when she had her third child, me. And I think I was still playing with action, man. At that age, it's incredible how they managed to do that. I didn't do very well at school, if I'm honest. I was quite lazy at school. I did well at the first lot of exams, all levels or all grades. I forget what they were called. Yeah. They keep changing, don't they?
Yeah.
So I did well with those, but didn't work for my hires and failed them all. First time around, so I got one C first time round, and that wasn't a big enough kick up the butt for me to work in my final year at school. And I scraped two more C's. So, and bearing in mind, my sister had just finished her PhD, and here was the youngest son, sort of failing most of his exams. That was a tough time for me, and I didn't really know what I was going to do with my life, really. I didn't have enough qualifications to go to university like my brother and my sister had done. And so I got a job, and it was the best thing I did. I was an office junior for a firm of solicitors called Morton Fraser Milligan, now Morton Fraser. And I worked in a general office with women in it. And it was such a great grounding for me in office politics and the way an office works and how to do things effectively and efficiently. So, and I was surrounded by really good quality people. Mm-hmm. And that was a real catalyst for me wanting to have a career. I actually managed to get sponsored, can you believe, despite those poor exam results. I got sponsored by British Coal to be a mining engineer. So as part of that, I had to go and work down in Yorkshire for a year, and then I was going to go to university to this day, I still think they thought that my 3 C's at higher was 3 C's at A level. Right. I'm convinced that's why they let me in.
Leads into any digging into. As I could mind them their way.
That's your dirty jokes are started already. Yeah. I saw a little anecdote about the assessment centre. But my wife still laughs at the thought of me being an engineer. I'm the least likely person to do any DIY that he could ever imagine. And we're down at an assessment centre, and this assessment was you had half an hour. There was a pile of Meccano, that's one for the kids, on the left-hand side. And then there was a Meccano model that side. I can't remember what it was. Let's say it was a fourth road bridge, to use Billy Connolly's joke. And I had half an hour to build that thing. And there was somebody sitting at the opposite side of the desk observing what I was doing. And but at the end of the half hour, I just had a pile of Meccano. I'd literally had not put one thing together because I had to start again, and then I ran out of type. And he said, right, we'll stop there. And I just sort of smiled at him, and he winked at me. And the feedback I got was, this is not a test about your Meccano skills. It was a test of your emotional intelligence. And the fact that I was smiling at the end, I was quite relaxed about it. I didn't panic. I was happy to start again if I didn't think it was going well. They quite liked. And if I think to myself now, actually, I think that's right. Actually, I do have those qualities that have stood me a good time. Now, I got through, I did the mining thing. It was a disaster. Mm-hmm. I hated it. I did it for about 6 months. I lasted starting shifts at 5:30 in the morning. I just wasn't really interested in the topic. Mm-hmm. It did get quite engineering-y, which really wasn't my thing. So I left, which is quite a brave move at the time. It felt, mm-hmm. What am I going to do now with my life? And I managed to convince Napier University to let me on there, about to start HND in business studies. Mm-hmm. And I just never looked back.
That's quite a journey already.
Yeah.
It's a few years.
Yeah, it was a bit of a false start, I guess.
I think that gives you greater motivation. I find that even halfway through my degree, I switched to a different degree from civil engineering to construction management. But that switched on a light in me, and then I started to perform when I enjoyed what I was sort of doing, so I can see that in your journey.
I think the switch for me was I matured a bit. I mean, I wasn't really ready to learn and knuckle down. But the switch for me was that I realised I have to work at things. If I want something, I'm going to have to work at it. It's not going to happen. It's not going to come to me. So I'm going to have to graft. Now, luckily, I'd picked business studies in Napier. I joke, because it was on the 32 bus route from my mum and dad's house, and it literally was. But it was really good of them to let me in. I fell in love with the subject matter. I loved the tutorials and the debate about the topic. I used to study for the first time at listening to Financial Times television that was on in the background. I really went into the degree course. I think I did 1 year, and then went into the second year of the degree. And did really well. I remember there was a girl in the degree course, and I thought, God, she's really clever. She's going to do really, really well. And she was getting top marks for things. And when it came to the finals, I walked into one of the exams for the finals, and she said, "Oh, Anthony, come and sit next to me so I can copy." And I was thinking, oh my goodness, you're the one that I really admire. And so I think I really embraced it.
Yeah.
Got into it. Managed to do quite well at that, and then began my career. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, I got a bit of a false start to my career as well. Actually, I was quite ill in mm-hmm. my sort of early 20s. I developed ulcerative colitis, mm-hmm. so inflammatory bowel disease, which is just a devil of a disease. I had quite bad bouts a bit, and over the first couple of years of my career, so that helped me back a little bit. I didn't take a graduate job. I joined Royal Bank of Scotland mm-hmm. because I'd worked there for one of my summer holidays, and I'd made some connections. They asked me to come and help out, so I did that. I then had to go and have an operation for the colitis. Mm-hmm. Spent about 3 months in hospital, 6 months off work recovering. To fix that, Yeah. You know, a complete fix. And I'm not a day off with that since, actually. So that was, again, that was another, I guess, key life moment for me. I remember recovering from the operation, lying in hospital, thinking that probably the rest of my life would just be about getting by and surviving. How could I possibly flourish in a career if I've had to go through this and I'm going to be scarred physically and mentally and for life over it? And my Auntie Jane came in with my Uncle Gerard, and she said to me, "Our window cleaners had exactly the same operation as you, and he's up and down that ladder." And it was a moment of, well, he's got like a really physical job. Of course I can sit in an office and do my thing.
Yeah.
So that was a nice kick up the bum, actually, to you know, pull yourself out of this, Anthony. This is, now you're not going to be held back with health. You can go and do your thing. And I did. I got into credit cards at Royal Bank of Scotland, and we had the ambition to be the biggest credit card provider in the UK. Barclaycard had that position. The Americans were coming in at the time, and I had a great time as a products manager, developing new products and putting them out to market. And in those days, I got a kind of end-to-end responsibility. So from the card design to the pricing to the marketing, it was a really, really good
apprenticeship,
if you like, for me.
Yeah.
You must have built quite a bit of resilience going through that so young as well.
I think, probably looking back at it at the time,
no,
I was unaware of it. You know, I was just, in fact, I'd quite a poor attitude, you know, when I was in the hospital thinking, all right, that's it, it's about survival now. But yeah, and I suppose other people influenced me, you know, the Auntie Jane in that case. I guess I did, without realising it. I mean, at this point, I'd never thought what sort of career I was going to have. I was just doing my best and I was just enjoying myself. You know, children started to come along, you're sort of grappling all that kind of stuff as well. So I never actually aspired to do what I'm doing now. You know, I just knew I was enjoying myself.
And academia didn't stop there. I mean, you also went to Harvard Business School, which is amazing as well.
Yeah, lucky enough to do that. I think I've got my dad's brains and my mum's leadership skills. So my dad was very brainy. And even though I didn't do well at school, if I apply myself, I was fine. Yeah, that was a really good place.
How did that come about then?
It was sponsored through our Royal Bank of Scotland, actually. Yeah. So we took a lot of their people in the Fast Track programme to do that. Didn't last very long. It was not an MBA, but it's nice to experience what they do in Harvard and do the case studies, the famous case studies. Was good fun.
Amazing.
And do you think that's just the maturing over the years with the success with the courses at Napier or Harvard is different from school?
Yeah, I'm quite competitive. And I am competitive. So a lot of it is motivated by wanting to do really well and get a bit of an ego boost out of that sort of thing as well. Yeah, it's there's no doubt about that. I don't know how many years it's been since I went to uni. It's probably 30 years. Yeah, probably about 30 years. And still nice to talk about it, actually.
I've read up about how long it is since we were at.
Yeah, similar. Both, we're all 1970 babies.
Oh,
so there you go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there we go. We've got that in common. So
one of us is doing very well then.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. moving on. Yeah. So talking about years, you mentioned Royal Bank of Scotland. You've had 25 years in senior roles with Aviva, Friends Life, Direct Line. You mentioned RBS. So how do you think those experiences along the way have helped you with your position now?
They really have really helped me. I mean, I'd only ever worked for FTSE 100 businesses before I joined Origo as their chief executive. And this was an SME. Mm-hmm. At the time, there was about 60 people in the business. So it was a real culture shock for me to join that business. You know, things like if you're last in, you have to lock the door and put the alarm on. And we all help out with, you know, coffee machine and things like that. So that was very different to a FTSE 100, but actually Origo already did things across the whole industry. So I was very used to doing things that would impact the industry, and Oracle did that. So we do 95% of all the pension transfers in the UK. So I was used to having that sort of impact, but in a smaller organization, it was difficult. So yeah, what did it bring? I mean, I guess, without realizing it, I had lots of stories and anecdotes and lots of experience about situations, which I think helped. I guess there was a professionalism there that I'd learned in these big companies. Definitely a commercialization. So an ethic of, you know, how can we hit that number and how can we drive profit? When I joined, actually, Oracle had a not-for-profit ethos.
Yeah.
And that was very different as well. And very difficult, you know, to try and deliberately not make a profit. It's quite difficult, because what happens if you don't even do that? You've made a loss, and where does the money come from if you do make a loss? So we've changed that since. But it felt, because I was working in a similar industry, so at this point this was from Aviva, so I was working in life and pensions. Oracle does a lot of life and pensions stuff. So I was interacting with some, you know, a lot of people from the industry I knew. So that felt fine. I'd been working in Yorkshire, in York. So it was lovely to come back to Edinburgh. So that was nice. Remember at the time, my three children weren't that enamored with it. They very quickly fell back in love with Edinburgh. I mean, the two older ones don't really remember Edinburgh the first time they were, what, 3 and 5.
Yeah.
My youngest was born in Yorkshire. It's been very sad, actually, that the Yorkshire accents are sort of dwindling now after 7.5 years. But yeah, no, it wasn't that much of a culture shock.
And the ownership of Oracle at that time, would some of those players be around the board table? Yeah. Would that have helped, you know, client, customer, customer, so. Client?
So yeah, I think so. Oracle was owned by 12 of its biggest customers. So
yeah.
35 years ago, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think 4 of them put some money into a pot.
Yeah.
And Oracle, I think it was just a 1-year project, or maybe 2-year project, to look for things that could drive efficiencies in the market. So as the internet was just getting going, how could companies interact with each other efficiently?
Yeah.
And it just very quickly grew beyond that. So yeah, it was owned by 12. The bigger ones had a seat on the board as well. And it was a very sort of steady sort of business. You know, it had taken 29 years to get to about a 6 million turnover. It was it just had a few services, key ones being the pension transfers I mentioned, and this Unipass identity, where financial advisors use it every day to log into the systems they need to get into it. Kind of dominated what it did. And its governance, whilst it was brilliant having these shareholders who were also customers and also very knowledgeable about what we did, from a governance perspective, if we wanted to do anything significant, like spend, I think it was more than £200,000, or invest in another company, or divest shares, you know, things like that, we needed not board approval, but shareholder approval. 75% of the votes going. So, and that was a real governance overhead for these shareholders as well.
Yeah.
Strategically, we were in an interesting place because the big two services dominated. We wanted to diversify what we did, and we needed money to do that. We also aspired to be selected to build the pension dashboard initiative, and we didn't have enough money to do that, and it wasn't fair to ask these 12 companies for that money that the whole industry was going to benefit from. So the board and then eventually our shareholders agreed that the best thing for the business would for it to become independent.
Yeah.
And that's what we did.
Well, we'll come back to the move there to with MBO and the private equity a bit later. So
it's an interesting setup. I guess prior to that, some people talk about if we've been a company they never go back. You don't believe in that, because I think where Aviva was another one you did
draw back as well. Yeah, sure.
So if you think about earlier part career, when you're moving around these really large corporate, well-known companies, is there standout lessons maybe in the leadership side or innovation side that you can think of?
I think there was. I remember where was I leaving? I was leaving Royal Bank of Scotland to join Bank of Scotland. And I had missed out on a promotion. And there was my managing director was leaving to go and do something in America. I think I was on the list of succession plan, but a new chief exec came in and said, look, I'm going to go external. So I was disappointed. I was not expecting it, but I would have wanted it. And I just, that emotional intelligence I talked about, I just stayed calm in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And said, look, I understand doing that. I'm more than happy to do the role on an interim basis. And I'll help onboard whoever you find. But of what I wouldn't mind is if you help sponsor me into what I do next, you know, with my career. So very kind of matter of fact about it. Went home and got really angry.
But at you're the allowed time, to swear on this podcast.
Oh, you are? Great. Yeah.
Fucking that's annoyed. A fact. We'll have to edit that bit.
And what it, I guess the lesson there was, well done, Anthony, for staying calm in the moment and, you know, not throwing your toys out the pram. And I then went back to Royal Bank of Scotland. So I didn't burn any bridges, yes, with doing that. Most of the matter of fact, I think every single one of my roles that I've taken on is because somebody's asked me to do it. Mm-hmm. So I can't remember the last time I applied for a job and... sent in a CV and you know, it just didn't happen. It doesn't happen really these days either. Mm-hmm. It was all about, I feel as if I can do more. Oh, well, why don't you come and work with us? Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I'll go and do that. Because I haven't fallen out with too many people and I've stayed mature, it allowed me to go back.
Yeah.
Going back to Aviva, I mean, if I'm really honest, that was probably the toughest one or the tougher one. I had left Aviva to join... I did some consulting actually for for about 18 months and then I joined Friends Life on a contract and stayed and really enjoyed that. I was down in London while we were still living in Yorkshire and it was going really well. And if I'm honest, the only reason I went back was because Aviva bought Friends Life. So it wasn't me going back to the mothership. And I actually find that quite difficult because people that... perhaps were below me in the structure. And I remember I said I was competitive.
Yeah.
I had maybe gone above or at the same level. I was earning far too much money by this point for the grade I was put into, you know, back in Aviva, and that was quite difficult. the remit I had was quite tough as well. So that was a tough one. I just sucked it up and looked for other opportunities and one absolutely landed on my lap with Oracle.
Brilliant. Good. Yeah, it's never a straight line. It's a good lane.
Yeah. So outside of work, you know, I'm interested to understand your personal influences, like your family. I know you're very close to your family and your hobbies are, we met in a business group. So is there anything like that that's helped shape your leadership or given you motivation?
I think so.
And, you know.
When it's funny, when people ask if you've got any hobbies, I sort of think, oh God, I don't actually. Because I'm very family oriented.
Yeah.
They might scoff at that, but bloody hell. Yeah. I used to love skiing. Yes. I had a bad skiing accident earlier this year. So I'm going to need to find a new safer hobby. Other than that, yeah, it's family actually. I mean, I have three girls, wife, a mother and father still alive. So I'm, you know, and a sister. I'm sort of surrounded by girls. That's it.
Yeah,
well, that's really shaped me, I think, in a really positive way, and it's made me determined in my business to make sure that women have a voice and that, you know, typically men are more confident beyond their abilities, I would say, in business, and women are perhaps less confident, but I've got probably more ability, would be my view. So I want to make sure that that works out, you know, well in order to go. So yeah, pretty mundane really.
You know, but that support network, I mean, you mentioned the accident there. I mean, you know, rallying around you, and that's when you know. And then you mentioned previously with your condition previously, you were lying in your hospital and your Aunt Jane came in. I mean, these moments. You know, I've had a similar incident with after a running collapse, but you sit there and think, you know, this is, you know, what it clarifies what's important.
It's everything.
And all of those things and gives you a bit of focus to fight. And you sound as if you've had a few bouts of adversity where you're like, you, as you say, may not realize to, but it's shaping who you
I think this one, if I'm honest, maybe because I'm still recovering from it. And this one was probably the toughest.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. And tough for my wife as well. There was no risk of me dying with ulcerative colitis. It was just a case of how thin do they let me go before they operate. Whereas I developed sepsis and pneumonia, and my intestines became paralyzed. And my wife was given the message that I probably wouldn't make it. And I was completely oblivious to it. So there was no resilience there. It was just, I just got through it. The doctors did a fantastic job. That's tough for her. Actually, she's shown great resilience throughout it. We're both fine with that now. Again, typical, I think, of me, there's been no epiphany. I'm just cracking on with the agenda I've got. It's probably made me think, well, how long do I want to keep going?
Yeah.
That's probably changed. It does make me think about the end of my career, and maybe I won't be as busy as I maybe thought I would be before. But this has been the toughest one, physically and mentally. But I think I'm there now.
And do you think that's your character, or your life and your family's character? Or do you think that's because it's so scary in a way, it's just, it's best to move on?
I don't know. Yeah. I think I'm probably quite stoic. I'm probably, I no doubt have resilience, and I get that from my mum and my dad. I have had a few things happen that, you know, that I've flourished as a result of. I'll probably flourish from this. I'll probably use it as a catalyst for something else. But it's also just a dull, just get on with it. you got to get on with it.
Well, that's quite a human thing, quite a Scottish thing, isn't it, to get on? It's not even ignoring what's happened. It's just you're stoic, and the next day comes along and you have to get through that. And it's the same business-wise as well. So if we think business-wise, Origo, going 35 years, you're in the CEO, they must through that time, some of the changes and the speed the market's changing as well. What sort of challenges, setbacks have you had to deal with?
I don't think we've had any. It's been a consistent growth story. I suppose what was tough was getting through the governance of making the business become independent. Was tough, but it took about 18 months.
And do you think that your position in the market, because you did have the ownership structure prior to your MBO, do you think that's helped with your position, and therefore that you're saying there's been a smooth ride? How you beat technology, because you're leading.
It's probably the only thing I was worried about with independence was, would our former shareholders fall out of love with us?
Yes.
Be less interested in us. And actually, if you speak to them, they did say at the time that the only thing that they were worried about was actually wanting continuity of the great service that we were providing to them. So they weren't really that fussy about the ownership. It was just they relied on us for the services that we provided for them. So those two things, though, are, they work together. Mm-hmm. Fine, we're happy. We'll absolutely invest in our services to make sure we give you an even better service. We also, to keep that interest and to keep the intimacy with the former shares, we've got them on an advisory board.
Yeah.
So we meet twice a year with that, and it's great. It's like... Yeah. It's like the good old days, and we get great ideas from them. They tell us about their pain points, and we have a go at delivering against those with services as well. I think all of our solutions that we've got, they've all come from our customers, listening to our customers.
That's interesting, because the next question I was going to ask was getting into a bit more detail about your transfer service. I mean, it's quite phenomenal figures. You're now, you handle 90%. Of the defined contribution pension transfers, which comes at a total of over £200 billion.
Over the years,
You've reduced average times from 53 days to 9 days by digitising what was an analogue service. And my question was going to be, what have you learned about driving innovation in legacy-heavy industry? So I suppose you're almost have seen your advisory there is helping keep you at the forefront of that. you know, I suppose there's an end more tired of it.
But yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to join the business when it was already doing very well in transfers.
Yeah.
But the stories in the business are about how difficult that was to get traction. Mm-hmm. Because prior to our service, it was done manually. I think a few of them had a spreadsheet that they would email around each other at the end of the night. And Oracle was asked, is there any way that you can make this more efficient? And that's what it was born. But in the early days, when there was only a few customers on the service, it was hard yards. We didn't have that network effect. And now the more people that join it, the better it is for everybody, using a consistent process to switch pensions. So I think the lesson is, again, it's resilience, it's keep going. It's have the end game in mind and just work towards that. Don't give up on things. We've got that now with some of our newer services. So we've launched a thing that digitizes the advisor's letter of authority process. It's very paper, post, fax, can you believe, process. It's a nightmare for our financial advisors who are asking providers, what has my client got? Mm-hmm. It's a nightmare for the providers who are inundated with these requests, which are really inconsistent as well, and that's quite slow. So we've digitized that, and it's taken its time to get traction. It really only works when you've got all the advisors using it and all the providers at the other end. So these things take time.
But
so
it's a validation of the new toys that you're bringing.
Being resilient. The team at Oracle are incredible. I mean, I'm not a I was a marketer trade, and that's the route I came up. But to work with, you know, proper, clever experts who are really good at delivery, it's just been great. It's been good, you know, great for me. I get to work with the people. It's like, I imagine I've joined Sony. And I get to work with the people that invented the Walkman and things like that, because they're still in the business and still doing amazing work.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a nice combination. My style with proper experts seems to work really well.
And in terms of your style, think about some of the clients we are working with at Moment, advisory boards that we've been on as well, and quite a common thing at the moment is everyone seems to be going to such a speed. Boards are trying to keep up, leaders are trying to keep up, and there's that balance between the short-term vision but keeping a handle on the long-term vision. So I'm wondering, in terms of you specifically in your leadership, how do you handle that, where there can be so much going on in the short term, but you have to know where you're going, particularly in your market?
Yeah, we have quite firm views on that, actually, which is I'm very clear what success looks like, and so is everyone in the business. So we have a vision, and we have a strategy, which is quite simple as well. And anything that isn't on that strategy is a distraction.
Yeah.
So, you know, we everybody has got objectives aligned to one of those things on that strategy as well. We've got private equity partners, I'm sure we'll talk about, who are very patient. They're very bought into our strategy. We're completely aligned with them around that. I'm also determined that nothing goes out the door unless it's of real quality.
Yeah.
So in that whole of, if you only had three things, speed, cost, or quality, which, you know, how would you apportion your 100% to them? I'm 60% quality, because it needs to be right for the customer, that needs to be a great experience. So I refused to be rushed, regardless of what the industry's doing. There's I'd rather get it right first time than make a mistake. And
it's interesting. You've almost answered what was going to be my next question. And your background, your previous question as well. You span marketing, product, consulting, commercial, and you've just said there, you know, if it's not right for the customer, you can have all the technical aspects, but it's the product that has to meet the needs and you know, deliver with a good value proposition. So I mean, I don't know whether you need to, you know, understanding the pain points. Is there anything further you would add to that?
Well, it's funny. My very first day at university, or the first day I was in a marketing lecture, the lecturer was called Peter Moody, and I remember him very well, very funny, very wise man. And he was quoting a definition of marketing, which has just stayed with me my entire career. And it is to give customers what they want profitably.
Yep.
So you've got the commercial side of things, but also the razor-sharp focus on what the customer wants. And you will never go wrong if you do those two things, and I've still got that as an ethic mm-hmm. in business. So we run workshops with our customers when we're developing products, just to make sure it works within their businesses. One of our recent ones, we had something like 60 subject matter experts from across the industry, not Oracle folks, but mm-hmm. people from our potential customers helping build the proposition. You can't go wrong if you do that sort of stuff.
And that will speed up development as well.
It does.
You know, it helps you scope out the projects. Because I know your guys work on, or have the pleasure of speaking to some of your developers, so you use the agile method, which I think works well within a business when you've got a house full of developers.
Yeah, we don't have it as a religion. We use a sort of hybrid approach. We do sprints and things like that. Yeah. But we've never gone full into that. I think sometimes sometimes you can forget actually, well, what end result did we actually want? You can go in different directions. So the chief commercial officer and chief operating officer, I've got quite a strong view about the type of agile that we use.
Yeah, so almost define the scope, and then agile is just for small elements and that's sprints. Yeah, cool.
And is that hard to keep to all the time, do you find? Was everyone bought in?
I think they are, yeah. And you wouldn't enjoy yourself at Oracle if you were I've got the religion of agile. And we probably wouldn't recruit as well. So yeah, people do enjoy them. I mean, it can always be improved what we do. Absolutely, we're not perfect, but we do think through things in chunks and regular releases, regular improvements, rather than let's try and deliver that by October 2026. And it's by then the market's moved on.
Good. So all this technology, you've got the transfer service process, the integration hub, the Unipass you mentioned as well, which I'm sure a lot of people around our age are older will be soaking it's there, because it's speed is the thing that lets things down there. But again, going back to you, the management team, your leadership, has that helped you in how you're scaling all these digital processes?
I think so, yeah. I mean, in fact, everybody in the leadership team, we think big. You know, we would never launch something that was just for one customer. You know, we do things for the entire industry. So we think big. We're looking for pain points that are being experienced, and we're looking for sort of consistent methods that could eliminate that. So yeah, we've definitely got that ethic within the leadership team are quite diverse, from diverse backgrounds, and that helps as well. So we've got a real diversity of thinking there as well. It's a very safe place to disagree, and that's great. And I'm very kind of malleable. I'm definitely not always right, particularly when it comes down, you know, to I've got proper experts that can do that. Mm-hmm. The clever thinking. So I do most of my time listening.
Yeah.
And that follows through actually in our board, our new board. And the old board was a similar, but nothing ever really comes to the vote. It's always a discussion, and I think that is the right thing to do. Yeah, but let's do that rather than a dictatorship or anything nasty like that.
I think safe places are a good one, and that sort of maybe high challenge but high support as well. Sounds like you've got
absolutely
the response.
Yeah, it's okay to do that with me. You know, any member of staff knows that they can take the mickey out of me, or they can challenge me and so on, publicly, privately. That's fine. That's we know what we want to do, and let's have some fun along the way as well.
Exactly. Just a question that we're asking virtually everyone this question, but AI and how you're embracing that, or is already part of your products already, or how do you see the future of that impacting maybe the data that you gather and how that's used?
Yeah. I think first of all, the last part of that question first. Let's be honest, I'm probably going to work another 4 or 5 years before I retire. I'm of that age. And I think AI will transform the way that I work before I retire. You know, it's here, it's now, it is already changing the way I work. I've changed my search engine and my Google, for example, to go straight to Perplexity. Mm-hmm. It's a way of doing it. And within Origo, we're absolutely embracing it. So whether it's our developers using it to be more efficient about the way that they create code or the way that we test the code as well, whether it's in marketing to help drafting rather than finishing, or checking quality of output for things. In the finance area, we're absolutely using it to analyze numbers and to think about things as well. Our board meetings are recorded.
Yeah.
The minutes and actions are in my inbox before I reach my desk again and the board as well. So that, you know, we're doing all that. We're looking at, I can't give too many details, but we're thinking about, well, how can we have this as part of our services to our customers?
Yeah.
And you've hit the nail on the head. You know, data is the obvious first place to do
it.
To allow our customers to manipulate the data that goes through our services for their own benefit. Or for financial advisors analysing the outputs they get from providers and platforms in a really efficient way as well. So, yeah, it's absolutely changing everything.
And it's exciting. You know, you've got to embrace it, I think, or you'll be left behind.
You will. Yeah, you will. Absolutely.
So, I suppose moving to consumers, the pension dashboard, you launched that ahead of time April this year.
Oh, that was not launched ahead of time.
Not? Oh, my wrong fact there.
Did you use artificial intelligence from that?
I'm sure you told me that.
I mean, the pension dashboard program is not his original date, but actually it's a prize worth waiting for. It's a very complicated program, but it's not ahead of time.
So how will it benefit the consumer, I suppose? Because I can see what it can do for the advisors and so on.
I mean, simply, the pension dashboard will allow consumers to go online and as if by magic see all their pensions in the one place. Mm-hmm. So that sounds simple, but actually it's the biggest pension project of a generation, really, to do that. The way it'll benefit them is that at the moment, Britons are not saving enough for their retirement. But they don't know it because they perhaps have 9, 10, 11 pensions. They get disparate statements. The statements are lovely, but they're all separate. They don't have this holistic view of what their retirement might look like. So the pension dashboard will give them, this is all your pensions. This is how much they're worth. And importantly, it will tell them an indication of their income in retirement. Now, most people, because Britons are not saving enough, are not going to like that number. It's going to be about, how much? How am I supposed to live on that? That's brilliant, because what it will do, I believe, is it will give them the kick up the bum that they need to do something about it, either go and get some financial advice, contribute more, think about what they're invested in, think about how long they might want to work as well, think about the cost of their current pension provider and so on and so forth. So I think it's the engagement that we need. There's also a problem in the UK of lost pension pots.
Yeah.
I think there's estimated to be £26 billion worth of lost pensions. But they're not really lost. I suspect when people come to retirement, they'll think, well, where did I work? I don't have that pension. I'll go and find that. But because they'll see it all on the one page, they'll no longer be lost. And it will include the state pension that's just connected over the last couple of weeks, which is brilliant. So they'll get a truly holistic figure, be able to be reunited with the ones that they maybe did forget about or the ones they never quite got around to updating their address and so on.
So it's pretty transformational.
Yeah.
And it's going to shine a spotlight in that area.
I think so. The pensions are a very dull subject for most people, let's be honest. And most people don't really understand how they work and that the absolute phenomenon of compound investment return is just incredible. I love the thought of a 30-year-old not liking the number they see in their pension dashboard, and they've got lots of time to do something about it. You know, the whole give up one coffee a day and you're absolutely sorted financially because of compound investment return. So, yeah, big program. The way it works, because a lot of people don't have online relationships with their pension provider or they've forgotten where their pensions are, the pension dashboard will do a proactive sweep of the whole market. Mm-hmm. Do you have Anthony Rafferty with these details on your books? Yes, I do. No, I don't. And if I do, here's the value of his pension and this is the income in retirement. So unlike open banking, which uses an existing relationship, this needed to be an industry-wide search. So that's quite a good bit of tech to do that, and then make sure that it's only the right actors that are on the system, so it's all secure as well. it's been tough. So the programme is now progressing really well, actually. We're at the stage where early adopting pension providers are onboarding to the infrastructure which we've built. That's going very, very well. The state pension is now connected, which is great and really important as well. So come October, the vast majority of pension schemes will be connected and consumers will be able to see tested first and now control test their pension dashboards. We're going to begin with one dashboard in the Money and Pension Service website. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a controlled fashion. But then eventually, still to get some dates for this, but eventually we'll be able to have what's called commercial dashboards. So the likes of Aviva or Royal Bank of Scotland's and ex-employers will be able to have their own pension dashboards to allow their consumers to see their own pension.
So that's exciting. And then the Unipar Select Authority that we've spoke about earlier on, that's broadly adopted by most financial advisors now, isn't it? I mean, the figures are pretty...
We're getting there, yeah. I think we're up to 40... I think it's up to something like 40,000 advisors have kind of registered to use it.
A fact, 8 out of 10 financial advisors are using it.
Oh, that's Unipar's identity.
Unipar's identity, okay.
So that's... And they use that multiple times a day, and they're not there yet for letter authority. They all use some sort of letter authority process within their business. Mm-hmm. Many are still done manually... Mm-hmm. Through the post or through email, but we're getting there with the adoption of that.
So whether it's the Unipar's identity or the letter authority, I mean, there must be a lot of collaboration involved there to get that working and out there. So can you talk about that a bit, how that works?
Well, we're lucky to have the, I suppose the Unipar's identity is a bit like our current account. So 80% of financial advisors use it multiple times a day. So if you like, we're cross-selling, we're using the footfall from that to add in some new Unipar services, letter authority being one of them. So that's really helpful. We're doing a lot of marketing, digital marketing, a lot of social media as well. There's a lot of financial advisors on X, Twitter, and on LinkedIn as well. So we use those quite extensively. We use our own database. Now we're well used to communicating with these customers, these advisor customers as well. So and they open our stuff. No, we don't bombard them with rubbish.
Yeah.
So we know them. It's from Origo. It's actually worth reading. And so our open rates are extraordinary. So yeah, it's going really well.
And how do you find that? Because we're quite interested in that, even simple things like business cards. Now we find, we just started last year. We have business cards. I'd say probably most don't. But social media, tone of voice, it's quite hard thing to get right all the time.
It is, yeah, it is. You definitely shouldn't do it 7:30 on Saturday night after half a bottle of red wine, that's for sure. I'm sure that's what some people are doing. But yeah, it's I guess that's about thinking about your tone of voice and being consistent to it, thinking about your brand guidelines, thinking about your target market and the personifications within that target market. So really, really strong marketing team that do that. Most people I meet these days from a business context say, every time I go on LinkedIn, like your bloody face is there, saying something. And it's just it's understanding the algorithm and having a really good team actually there that does most of that. Having something different to say. So, we, before we were selected to deliver the core architecture for the pensions dashboard, we were very vocal about the benefits of pension dashboards. We ran conferences and we did a lot of social media around that. We were the number one spokespeople in the market for it, championing it. And since we've won that, there's now no need to do that. So we talk about something else and so on. So it's all very thought through.
Yeah.
It doesn't just happen. It's amazing how you do a tweet a day or a LinkedIn post a day, you get a lot of traction.
Yeah. What are the numbers? We were surprised. I can't remember who we met earlier on in the year, but it's only 1% of LinkedIn are posting.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like that.
Yeah. Regularly. So, I mean, taking that position you have in the industry, you're also a director of the Scottish Financial Enterprise. You're also an NED, an advisor and other sort of positions that influence the market. So how do you use those positions to really sort of, for the good of the financial services industry?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the most significant one there is Scottish Financial Enterprise. I was amazed when I came back from England. I'd spent 12 years working in England, came back to Edinburgh. I was amazed that we had Scottish financial enterprise. There was nothing really similar in England, and its purpose is just to champion Scotland as a place to have financial service firms, either domiciled or have big significant offices in as well. Financial services makes up, you know, an enormous part of the Scottish economy.
Over 140,000 jobs in the
sector. Absolutely incredible.
It's amazing.
And we're determined that that continues to grow as well. We've got a great heritage in Scotland for financial services. We invented the ATM, the banknote and things like that. So I want to keep that going as well. And there's amazing, even though these companies are, you know, bitter rivals, you know, and from a consumer perspective, the collaboration is just incredible. And we joined the Scottish Financial Enterprise just after I joined. I was approached and I thought, this is going to be great for Origo to join us and to be able to network with other organizations. And then there was a position came up on the board, and I was fortunate enough to be given that. I really loved it. I'm on my second term now. I think I've done it for about six years. It was brilliant for me because when I joined Origo, I was a new chief exec. It was my first chief exec role. So I was new to all this board stuff. So too, and being the chief exec is a very different role to being a non-exec director. So it was a great experience for me to see things through the eyes of non-exec directors. Mm-hmm. I think I got better at predicting what questions I might get as a chief exec in Origo. Mm-hmm. Again, surrounded by just really clever people on that board. Mm-hmm. Very diverse board, you know, very senior people from across the financial service businesses. Learned a lot from them as well. There's probably not a week goes by where I've not been connected to somebody else who might be helpful for Origo as a result of SFE,
yeah.
Scottish Financial Enterprise. So just a great network. I'm loving it. I will miss it when I'm retired and no longer able to be on that board. But it's been great for Origo, great for me personally.
Great. And then you mentioned earlier as well that there's the change in ownership a few years back, wasn't there, with Origo? So private equity involved, how's that been in terms of being different? Any change in your focus, day-to-day culture, I suppose, would be another one, maybe?
It's terrible. Help. Well, you know what? I've talked before around the rationale for it was, yeah, wanted to raise capital, wanted a simpler governance. The shareholders got behind that, as did the board, and 18 months later, we did it. But we ran a really good process to select our partners. We were quite clear on the criteria that we wanted. One of them was, provide capital for investing in your services, your products. But the most important one was a cultural fit, because Origo is a lovely place to work. Our staff turnover rates are exceptional. I didn't want to spoil that, actually. And I had no experience whatsoever of private equity. I actually did have a thought, which was, this might be 5 or 6 years of hell, but ultimately worth it. And we chose them, Vespa Capital, a London-based private equity business. Typical fund size of about 300 million. Every investor is from the UK, so it's all UK money. A great track record for buying very sensibly. I spoke to every single chief exec from their portfolio businesses, and I got a very consistent, they're great. They do what they say they'll do. They'll never surprise you. It feels very collaborative. So we had a really strong feeling about it. And that's been the case.
They do quite a spread of investment.
I mean, they focus on tech and science, but they are broadening actually as well. Their process is great. I mean, I was shocked to know that it's only for every one investment they make, there's 100 that they'll assess. Mm-hmm. So they're very discerning about what they're looking for. It's been great, a real proper partnership. We meet monthly as a board, as one of them, sometimes two. On the board formally, there's five of us from Origo. We've got an independent non-exec director. Nothing's ever come to a vote yet. We're very transparent with them. It's all about, we want the same thing. We know what our strategy is, and we're just working against that.
The alignment you mentioned, That's important.
Really important.
I've been involved with a couple of companies, one in Scotland, one in Yorkshire, private equity. And I think if you get that alignment, I've got so much experience as well to offer that can really support the management team that are in the day-to-day.
Well, the experience is incredible. We, of course, maybe every business thinks this, but we thought we're quite a complex business and stuff we do is quite nuanced, quite niche, and they're never really going to, my God, they're so understanding about what we do, and they're just part of the team, really. I mean, they don't work in the business. We do it through the board and have a weekly one-to-one, but you would never know that they don't come from that background. The partner that's assigned to us, we were debating, I forget what it was, we were debating something, and there was a disagreement, which is absolutely fine, really healthy, over it. And he just put his hands up and he said, look, we'll always back you. You're far more experienced than us in this. So, you know, happy to support whatever you decide to do. And I thought, that's brilliant.
I think, I suppose, it's that variety. It's almost having that, you know, I don't know whether one's eclectic mix on the board. Thus, well, not make Chris stronger to even ask you these, you know, the questions, pose the questions to you, even if you know you're right. It gets you thinking and make sure you're going in the right direction. You're sure of where you want to go.
We've got each other's backs. I took the view straight away, which is I'm going to be completely transparent with them, you know, even about things like, well, I'm worrying about this. It's maybe not happened yet, or so-and-so's thinking this way. I don't, you know, so I share stuff like that. And it's just, I think it's just really helpful just to, and we therefore trust each other completely. So it's been wonderful.
What you've just said there, we were even on a call yesterday, we're speaking to a lot of investment firms, especially they're all saying that be transparent, and that honesty and the trust comes out.
Be genuine. I think if you're telling your story properly, that means you can attack what needs to get better, or you're talking about the right amount or the inflection point you're at. I think no surprises. It's the best, absolutely the best way to be.
I mean, in 35 years, you've led from an analog to a digital, digitizing the financial services industry. What's your vision for Origo as you move forward, and what are the key principles that will guide your leadership to transform the sector further?
Good question. It's probably a very boring answer, actually, which is more of the same. And by that, I mean, you know, our vision is connected financial services. We think of ourselves as the plumbing of the industry, so that stuff just happens more efficiently. So it's more of the same. So it's still a very inefficient market that we work in. We've got no imminent plans. We are looking at it, but no imminent plans to do things internationally, because there's more than enough to do in the UK. So it's more of that. At some point, our private equity partners will want to get off the bus. So at some point in the future, you know, we need to think about, well, what's the best home for Origo? Mm-hmm. I think that'll be fine, because anybody who wants to invest in Origo, you know, wants to be sure that its customers would be comfortable with its ownership. So that'll take care of itself in the future. Sorry, boring answer, but more of the same, more connecting financial services for the benefit of everyone, be that financial advisor, be that a provider, a platform, an end customer, or another software provider. That's where we see our role. So more of that.
And I think there's nothing wrong with more of the same, because sometimes we've seen it, boards, companies feel the need to shift gear, change market. And it's the journey that if it's working, and it's finessing that or having the right management team that can be thinking about the short term and the future, absolutely fine for more of the same. What about culture then? Because we're all the same year, say age, generations are very different now. Work, whether it's after COVID, has changed. There's hybrid models.
Yeah.
So the culture that comes across, how important this to you, the teamwork, so important. Can you talk a bit about how you get that culture right?
Yeah, it's really important. And we're quite careful about our recruitment. So during the recruitment process, first of all, we're quite clear on what our culture is, so it's written down. It's you just know, you know, what reinforces the culture. It's really obvious within the business. I spend a lot of my time pointing out really positive things that reinforce the culture. People don't realize I do that, but that's what I do. That's a great example of such and such. So it's obvious what our culture is. It is, sorry to use the word, it is very nice. So we are very collaborative with each other. It's absolutely a place where it's safe to disagree. You know, we learn from our mistakes and things like that. We don't cover things up. I love it when people say, oh, I got that wrong. Mm-hmm. But here's what I'm going to do about it. I love that. So we're very mindful of that as we recruit. Mm-hmm. So we ask lots of questions to try and tease out the personality of the person. We deal with things that perhaps are anti-cultural. So we definitely don't tolerate that. So as much as we're nice, we're quite ruthless when it comes to not wanting to spoil that culture for everyone else. And we've grown. So in my time, we've doubled the number of staff within the business. We've become an independent private equity backed business during my time as well. And yet it still feels very similar, actually. It still feels like a lovely place. Our staff turnover has got slightly worse, but it's still really, really good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it comes with a territory where the age profile has really changed to your question. You know, when I joined, the average age was just over 40. The average age. And I couldn't tell you what it is now, but you know, I was in last Wednesday and we're having a summer games, Olympic games style thing over the next 6 weeks. And there was a ton of the limbo. And these young men and women,
I wouldn't do that after your accident.
Absolutely not. I would have done it before the accident.
Yeah.
So it does feel much younger as a place, which is great, and we learn from them. So the artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a number of real champions of that within the business, and that's younger people.
I suppose the next question I was going to ask, in terms of with your experiences and if you're passing in terms of leadership style for the fintech industry, you just mentioned all the younger crew coming in there. I mean, what traits would somebody need, and what does industry need that may not be the norm now? Where could you see the leadership?
For leadership, or
yeah, as leadership goes on, how do they, or do they just need an openness and that, and all of the qualities you just said there about allowing to make mistakes? But how do you? It's very fast paced.
I suppose the other thing that, you know, old fuddy duddies like me who are not the proper experts at the stuff, you know, that ends up in the customer. It's just being curious and respecting someone else's expertise. I think that's probably a good trait to do well. You know, listening to your customers is really important. There is a joke, and I quite like it, in Oracle that, and it's certainly not one that the young people get, but they've learned it now, which is, my style is very much like young Mr. Grace from Are You Being Served? And because what he did is he made people feel good about themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd be wheeled out in his wheelchair inappropriately with a young woman, typically. But I certainly don't do that. But he would say, you're all doing very well. Mm-hmm. And they would, you could see the face of the pride. And I'm so, that's my mum coming out in me, the fact that I do that, which is, my mum never had to tell me when I'd done something wrong or when maybe it was disappointing. I just knew it. But my God, when I did something right, it was a wonderful experience. And you know, the praise and the recognition that I'd get. And that's very much my style. I don't spend a lot of time pointing out mistakes. I don't sign off PR stuff or stuff. I'm trusting of that. And people know themselves if they get things wrong, be it a bit of coding or whatever. But I do spend a lot of time praising the great work that goes on. And I think that's probably a generic ethic that whatever the industry, I think I think it's a strong one for a leader to have.
Yeah, brilliant.
I'm going to ask about legacy in a second, but I'm just to wind all the way back to the start again and the conversation we've had the last hour. So you said earlier you feel your combination of your mum and dad, you get traits of both. What about your children? Do you see yourself in them? Are they a mix as well?
Yeah, I think they are. I'm beginning to sort of live my life vicariously through my children now. I'm sure people on Facebook are really sick of me posting about my girls. I'm it's so important to me that they flourish. I'm so determined that they work hard for themselves and that they're in a privileged position, but you wouldn't know it. And you know, they're taking their careers, you know, very seriously. So my oldest is finishing her master's She's going to do a PhD. She's a scientist, so that's what she's going to do, and she's doing so well at that. My middle one, like you, actually, has changed courses at university. She started doing primary school teaching, discovered that it wasn't really for her. It's a tough gig, that, and she's now gone back to what she absolutely loves and what she's great at, which is acting. So she's second year, about to start second year, doing a degree in acting. And my youngest is just turned 16, but her thing is sport. So she's managed to bag herself a scholarship in America to play hockey. And she's right now, she's in Holland at a European Championships playing for Scotland. So she's going to go and pursue that route. And I just love that. I just hate the thought of them being sort of lazy or thinking, well, you know what, my life's going to be fine. I love their ethics. So yeah, it's become everything. My wife is even more determined than me in that part and does amazing things with them so that they flourish.
Sounds like they're doing really well.
But doing all right.
So it's come across just how important the thing, family, where you've come from is. Well, your children are doing at the moment. You said you're competitive, so that's not.
We've caught on to that.
Well, they're not doing as well as me.
Yeah, that's an important point. But if you think of where you are now as well, just to finish off, Origo's going really well. You care about it. That comes across. So, I'm going to ask you about legacy. You mentioned maybe 5-6 years left. What would you like your legacy to be across either the work or with the family as well?
God, it's such a tough question. You're making me think about the end. You've thrown me there, actually.
Well, I think you're such a you've had such a successful career. It's varied, and I think the whole point of this podcast is meeting great people and hearing about yourself or great companies. And I think just that mix you have, that it's very upfront how you're trying to do things. You care about what you're doing, but you want that competitive success. So I do feel that this, I would say, we think about that. Hopefully, there's something left there.
Yeah, I was just going to say something that I've noticed. I mean, I've been a business group with you, Anthony, and whilst you say you're competitive as you're a mega team player, and whether that's your family or Origo, and you know that's what comes through. And even just hearing your energy there to say you want the people in the business to know that they're doing a good job. I mean, that's what I really, you know, I value that, is your input to anything. You know, business discussions we've had or friendship. And, you know, I think, you know, you're leaving a fantastic legacy.
Yeah, I think I actually do have a sense of my purpose in life, which, and I think I mentioned the phrase before, which is to make people feel good about themselves. And I suppose that is the legacy I think about, which is when I'm long gone, either from the business because I'm in retirement or because I'm dead or with family, it's a business that's flourishing and feels good about itself and confident about itself, and it's probably international by this point and flourishing. But it's certainly from a family perspective, it's the fact that they feel good about themselves and that they're doing the same with their children, and you know, yeah, the legacy goes on, and that they're flourishing in life and doing the best they can and happy and calm.
Yeah, that's what's a really good thought, isn't it?
Brilliant. Well, thank you for answering all the questions. We've now done a bit more, not that was heavy, but a light-hearted discussion, which we call off the cuff. And Gregor and I are going to fire some questions on you, and we don't want you to think about them too much, just quick-fire answers, and then we'll see what it takes us. Yeah, I think Gregor...
It's a psychometric bit.
Yeah. No, it's not a deep...
We've got the Meccano here, just basically... I was going to say, you always build bridges, but making not physical ones.
Metaphorically.
But just fair enough.
That took you 45 minutes to...
Well, I thought about it earlier, but I was waiting to get in. We'll cut it back.
I'll kick off.
Yeah, go for it.
Late or fashionably early?
Oh, fashionably early.
And what's your best habit and your worst habit?
Being calm is my best habit. Worst habit is probably procrastination.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you could take a day out with a week and replace it with a second Saturday, what day goes?
Oh, goodness. Monday, definitely Monday. Is that what you mean?
Yes, longer weekend.
Did you go Monday?
I did.
What did I go? Tuesday?
I don't know. If Orgel were a band, what genre of music would you be?
My goodness.
I think we would be... We'd probably be the background music in films. Because we're
why is that?
The plumbing of the market. We're in the backgrounds.
Is that an action movie or a comedy?
Or a romantic comedy?
Comedy, definitely.
A comedy.
And go with that. Secret superpower in the workplace?
Don't be a dick.
That's an excellent answer, isn't it?
I think you've answered my next question. What's one word your team would use to describe you?
Kind.
Okay. So we think you learn a lot from mistakes. So can you think of one mistake at work where you've actually learned from that's made things better ongoing?
When I was younger, I got 50,000 credit cards printed with an old lady in Southend-on-Sea's telephone number as a lost and found number. Oh. And that was quite an obvious mistake. So the lesson I learned there was, which actually I don't do now, but it's just quality. Just make sure things are right before they go out the door.
Yeah.
I guess I do that now still.
Very good. Zoom call or meeting in person?
I'm a believer that, and I didn't used to be, there's nothing from a business context you can do over Microsoft Teams rather than Zoom, actually. But what would I prefer face-to-face, I think. But it doesn't hold you back doing things over video.
Yep.
What are you most proud of?
My children.
Brilliant. Plane, train, or automobile?
Plane. And I'm brilliant at falling asleep within 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's getting
hard. I'm not good. Can you do that?
No, I'm not good at
it. That's really good. That's just another superpower.
Superpower, yeah.
So just to finish off then, just think about in a great conversation, business wise, life wise. So what do you love most about the business?
It's the people. It's definitely the people. We have a laugh. There was just the other day there, somebody emailed and said, there's birthday cake in the kitchen. And I replied and said, happy birthday. And he replied to me and said, it's not my birthday. It was just on discount in Morrison's. And that's just like the type of format. So it's definitely the people and, learning from them. I love leading the business, but it's definitely the people.
Brilliant. That's you. That's a gracious finish. You're off the call professional.
Yeah, well, from Greg and myself, we just want to thank you. I didn't even feel the time. The time just disappeared there. It was great learning about Orgel and your upbringing and all the things that have made you who you are, which is a fantastic person. And thank you for joining us on the For Me Too podcast.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Brilliant.
Exactly.
Cheers.